and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have a special guest. His name is Chris Grabenstein, and his new book is called Rolling Thunder. It's the newest John Sepeg mystery, just out in hardcover from, and I believe it's Pegasus Books. Hello.
Hello. Good to talk to you again, David.
Hi. Is that how your name is pronounced, Grabenstein?
I say Grabenstein.
It is Grabenstein.
I once was on a panel at a mystery conference and asked a German author, how the heck do I pronounce my name? He went, Grabenstein. So it's sort of like Frankenstein.
It is like Frankenstein. That's how I remember it now. So when you associate things with other things, then you remember easily.
It's like the scene from Young Frankenstein.
This has the brightest orange cover, or is it pink?
My wife and I have been debating. They were sort of like a salmon. It's not as pink.
Oh.
If you put it right up against my first book in the series, Tilt-A-Whirl, it's not quite that pink, but it's not the orange we were expecting either. Like the orange of a fluorescent vest.
You're kind of a twisted writer.
Oh, thank you.
And that I never know where your books are going, and then, you know, some of them start out and, you know, nothing's happening, and then all of a sudden something happens, and It throws the whole plot into a twist. And I like the way you do that. But you do talk about some twisted subjects in your books, especially the first one.
Yeah, the first one was off to, you know, there was a reason behind all that, but I don't want to give away the my motivation for putting that plot in there.
So you had an ulterior motive to do that?
Well, I knew who I wanted the murderer to be.
Right.
So then I did a lot of research into what would justify this type of person to become a murderer. And in 90% of the cases, the motive that I gave my murderer is the one that would cause that type of person to cause that murder. There's a great book that I found that was, in fact, it was an inside joke that very few people get, but it relates to a very famous, similar case in England. The case I had in my first book was based on some stuff that happened in England.
Yeah, the first Tilt-A-Whirl is quite a heavy book.
Yeah, it is.
Especially toward the end.
It's interesting how people... what I always try to do is go beyond the dark and go beyond the beyond and then bring everything back out in a hopeful way at the end. But, yeah, I try to make a... These are not light, fluffy reads.
No. Well, you never wanted them to be fluffy reads.
They're fun, but they're fun with that kind of, it's got that gallows humor going on, where it's the same kind of humor like cops use or people who work in emergency rooms, where stuff, if you didn't laugh, you'd be going insane, you know?
Right, exactly. You don't seem like the type of writer who would just write a plain book.
No, I try not to. I try to put some thought into it, and I'm very careful about what I'm trying to say.
Although, what's the definition of a plain book? I mean, something to me that would be plain, that wouldn't be very interesting, that would be tedious. I mean, but John Sepeg is far from tedious. He's a very, very interesting character. He doesn't stand for lies at all.
No, not at all. In a way, it was like a writer's discipline for me, too, to give him that character who will not lie, cheat, or steal. It's kind of impossible to get by in daily life without fudging things a little bit.
Exactly, but he never will.
He never will, and but that gives you a great challenge as a writer. Like, oh my God, how am I going to write this scene? Like, in Rolling Thunder, there's a moment where someone calls him on his code, and it's almost like he has to betray his partner to say it, but we find out he does have a way to stick to the code and also protect his partner.
Are these difficult books to write?
Well, they were, I don't know, you know, trying to come up with a new twist on a murder mystery, because how many, there are like 5,000 done a year. So I think now that I have the characters, they're not, like, tedious hard. They're not strenuously hard, because I know the characters so well now, and it's fun to see what happens as they grow together. I think one of the things people like about the series is I made a decision early on to grow to characters. You know, sometimes you'll pick up a mystery, and I guess even Sherlock Holmes and Watson, they were always the same, you know. No matter what they went through, the last adventure, the next adventure, they sort of started where they were. The adventure before. With this one, Danny's growing up a little bit, and CPAC's loosening up a little bit.
And Danny goes some personal stuff in here, which was kind of surprising for me. I didn't see it coming.
Yeah, he's going through some stuff. Yeah, he's at that age.
But Danny, I don't think Danny has completely grown up either.
No, not at all. In fact, I think the books would get boring if he did. He's got to stay, I think, somewhat in awe of CPAC, and also even... He's not aware sometimes about how good of a cop he actually is.
But you kind of get the feeling that Danny thinks that CPAC's a little too by the book sometimes.
Yes, I think so. In fact, I did a little short story for Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine that came out this June.
Which I'm in the middle of reading, actually, at work.
Oh, really?
Yes. I haven't finished yet, but it's very good. And it's so cool to see the characters again. I'm amazed you haven't written any other stories like that for Alfred Hitchcock or Ellery Queen.
Yeah, I'm thinking about writing some more. I did that when we thought that the CPAC series might go the way of the Gradoid Elephant as far as novels and disappear last year. And I said, well, I like these characters so much, I'll try to keep them alive. And I had been fortunate enough to bump into the editor of Alfred Hitchcock at a Mystery Writers of America dinner, and she said, when are you going to write out the story? And I said, oh, maybe I will. So
you did. You really did.
Yeah.
But how long does it take to write a short story like that? Some people say it's even harder to write a short story, to tell a story in that compact of a... You only have, what, 30 pages, 35 pages?
Yeah, about that. Maybe, get under 10,000 words. That's
and you have to tell the whole story. That can't be easy.
And also the endings are kind of truncated, too, because you want to have a big epiphany near the ending. Aha! And then wrap it up really quickly.
That's why, I mean, Edward D. Hawk, who is just fantastic at writing short stories like this, one of the few whose stories I could read over and over and over and over. I must have read 200 of his stories.
Yeah, they're it's good. I just got into doing them last year. Also, Charlene Harris asked me to write a short story for a collection she has coming out in August.
Wait a minute. You know Charlene Harris?
She's a big fan of CPAC.
Really? I didn't know that.
She's a really sweet lady from Arkansas. It's really kind of funny when you meet her because she is not who you think of, the creator of Suki Stackhouse. Blood and all that. She's a terrific lady. We've met and become friendly at author conventions, and over the years she's done a couple collections, and she's so generous. Like, she gets 12 authors together, and of course it's her name that sells the books, and we all get to reap the rewards of it. But they did a collection where she gave 12 authors vampires on their birthdays. She and Tony Kellner is her co-editor.
Mm-hmm.
And another one, Werewolves at Christmas. And this collection, I think we worked on it maybe 2 years ago, maybe a year and a half ago. They gave out the assignment, asked me to play, would you write a story about the paranormal on vacation? So I have that coming out. And that one took about a month to write that story, because it was all new characters and all new setting and stuff. And it only took me about a week to write the CPAC short story. So,
well, it's got to be a challenge for you. But is it a good challenge or a really hard challenge to come up with these new characters and new stories? And
It's a fun challenge. It's a whole new world. But, because you do, once you've created a CPAC and a Danny, you kind of know their quirks and stuff, and now it's just finding new and fresh ways to educate people who haven't read. Like with the CPAC short story, I figured a lot of people are going to be reading that who have never even heard of the books, because it's an Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine or whatever. So I had to, you have to find quick ways to establish their characters without boring the people who already know their characters. So there's always a lot of challenges. It's all fun, though.
Who would have figured that you knew Charlene Harris? I'm amazed. I'd like to have her on the show. I'd love to interview her.
Well, we're a very tight community, we folks. History world. Yeah, everyone's, very supportive, and it's a great community. And through Mystery Writers of America, we all kind of hang out. We see each other at conventions and stuff.
And she's just another American successor. I mean, look how many years she went and nobody read a lot. I mean, not nobody, but a lot of people didn't read her stuff, and now everybody's reading it.
Exactly. She's got like 10 of the top 10 books, like 5 of them are hers.
I mean, to suddenly feel that success after all these years has got to feel really wonderful.
Yeah, but she's such a terrific person, so we all love it.
Right. Now, we ought to talk about Rolling Thunder, though.
Yeah, sure.
Why don't you tell people who haven't read it exactly a little bit about it?
Well, we're back in Sea Haven. In the fifth book, I took the guys down to Atlantic City to get them out of their town. But Sea Haven's my fictional town down the Jersey Shore.
So there is no Sea Haven anywhere.
No, it's a combination of, there's a town called Beach Haven, which is on Long Beach Island, which is where I go every year to do my strenuous research. And then there's another place called Seaside Heights, made very famous this year by the MTV show Jersey Shore. That's where they do.
Oh, really?
That's where the situation hangs. Snooki, they're all in Seaside Heights. Because I wanted to get, Seaside Heights has the boardwalk, the boardwalk with all the Italian sausages and all the rides and the arcades and stuff. And Beach Haven is more the houses that people rent for a week at a time. So I put all that together in one place I call Sea Haven. And this episode, if you will, this book starts at the grand opening of a new all-wooden roller coaster on a pier that juts out into the ocean called the Rolling Thunder. And when it's on its inaugural trip, the first lap around the track, the owner and his family are all in the first car, and the owner's wife has a heart attack. And was it an accident, or was it something else?
Great way to start a book.
First one, actually. I try to start my books with a bang. I think it's all my early years of training.
I think that's important because you want to keep people interested. Definitely. I mean, you gotta keep it. They used to say Dick Francis would kill off somebody in the first page almost every book, and I was like, wow, that's a good way to get somebody interested in the book.
I always try to get like people laughing a little bit with CPAC, and then boom, hit them like, oh my God, what's going on? And you get to see who he is by him racing. He races up to the rescue on this heart attack. He doesn't get there in time. And then that it's not a murder, it's a death, and it's suspicious, and people are wondering about it. And we start hearing things that no one in the family liked this woman who died, and they all seem to have reasons for wanting her dead. And then just as we're sort of wrestling with that, another body is found, a dismembered body of a sort of a beach babe is found in the residential area of town. And slowly we start wondering if the two deaths might be somehow connected.
And, you know, it's interesting because one of the most interesting characters in the books is John Seabeck's father, who is just this heartless, awful man.
Oh, you should hear the audiobooks. The guy who does the audiobooks does him so well. It's creepy.
I can't even imagine what that must sound like. I mean, you instantly hate this man.
Yeah.
And your opinion of him never changes, really.
A little bit of... You could see that at some point he has that kind of, like, bad boy charm that, you know, on a 20-year-old would have been appealing, but now he's like... bitter drunk was really, he's just horrible.
Well, you're such a nice guy. How do you write such evil characters so well, being the nice guy that you are?
I'm not sure. I sort of, you know, I used to be an actor. Before I was a writer, I was an actor, and I think I've seen this character before. I think I've met this father character before, and so I sort of become that character when I'm writing it. So it is kind of frightening sometimes, because I sort of let the characters wash over me and take over me. That's why it was so frightening to hear Jeff Woodman, who's the narrator, reading it so well on the Audible version of the book. Like, oh my God. And at the very end of Rolling Thunder, that little scene between Seabeck and his father, I went back and listened to it twice. Like, wow, that was pretty knocked out. You know, pretty powerful stuff.
It's amazing when you think, you know, I used to think, wow, reading a book on tape, that must be so easy, but it isn't. I mean, there's so much involved with making it sound just right. You got to say every word just right.
Yeah, and I couldn't do it. I mean, I'm an actor, but I'm pretty good in live performance when I read my books out loud, but if you put me on tape, you go get this guy out of my ears, because there's a subtlety to it, because it's a very intimate performance. You know, it's right in your earbud.
And do you get approval on who does the audio, or do they...
I'm very fortunate that my wife is one of the best audiobook voiceover talents in New York City, so she knows everybody. And when Audible started talking about doing the CPAC book, she goes, I'll get Jeff Woodman, he's the best. And he's won all these awards and things.
Oh, really?
And he really likes the books, and he said, yeah, I'll do these, because he likes them a lot. It's interesting, because, you know, some people complain about the first person in present tense, but the actor loves them, because he says, by writing them in the first person, I'm basically giving an actor an extended monologue. You know, it's one real long soliloquy.
Yeah.
Everything, in a way, in the book, if you write a book in first person, even though you're recording other people's voices and things, what the narrator hears, you're always filtering it through their mind, so the actor gets to do the same thing. But these are all sort of Danny's impressions of people, as opposed to what the people might actually sound like. That's kind of complex stuff, but he just loves doing it. So
I wonder how John sounds on the audio tapes. He must have a very strong voice. He seems like he would be.
He's very good. He's very good at this sort of dry Danny kind of voice. It's not all the way to Joe Friday, which would make it a parody, but it's you know it's CPAC when he's talking. Joe comes on, Joe Seabeck, his father, and it's fun. I always download it as soon as it comes out, because it's been about a year since I wrote the book, and I forget some of what I put in them. I love listening to it and running around Central Park.
Now, how many are on audio right now?
I think all six are available on Audible and audio.
Right, but you can't buy the audio in the stores, can you?
No, that's, the great thing about Audible is it makes books like mine, which are kind of middle-level books, available in audio, because they don't have the high production costs of, you know, to burn CDs, put them in a box, wrap them in cellophane, put the boxes on trucks and ship them out. That's why audio books, if you buy a CD, it costs like $30, $40. And Audible is basically just the actor, an engineer, a little bit of editing, put the MP3 file online, and people download it to their iPods. And you can burn your own CD, but
right. You
don't have the physical product, so they're able to produce them at a cost that, you know, they're able to do more books than get done normally.
Now, you were with another publisher now, so you had a stretch there when you didn't have a book, and now you have, and you, I think you actually thank Otto Penzler for that.
Yeah, my agent, when we knew that the second company that acquired us wasn't going to do any more CPACs, went to Otto and said, is your imprint interested in picking up CPAC? And he said, I'd love to, but I only do, he does like two books a year, so he says, I really can't do that, but you might want to check with this guy named Claiborne Hancock, who is the runs a really small company called Pegasus Books, and I believe at one point Claiborne ran the well, that was New York blowing up in the background.
I heard that. Well,
somebody hit one of the metal plates on the street, I think.
Really? Wow.
Claiborne, I think, used to run the Otto Penzler imprint at Carolyn Graf back when he was there, and those were the first publishers of CPAC were Carolyn Graf.
He must have known they would pick it up eagerly.
Well, yeah, the guys, Claiborne, had remembered, I didn't work with him at Carolyn Graf, but he remembered how much everyone liked working on the books, and that's why they brought back the original designer that did the first three Carolyn Graf books. So it's been kind of great.
Yeah, it is great, and it's nice that you find a home for these. I mean, I can't imagine reading the series as much as I have. I've read them all, and I can't imagine not being able to read them anymore.
Yeah.
And you almost feel like calling up the author and saying, "We'll just write them for me," you know?
Yeah. But, I did the short stories, I'll keep the character alive, but it was a little touch and go this time last year, but it's looking better now. They're already in a second printing on Rolling Thunder, so that's a good sign.
Oh, really? That's great.
Yeah, it's only been out a couple of weeks, but... You know, they didn't order a ton of them, but all the ones that they printed have shipped out, so they ordered some more, so we're having a second printing.
That's great. I mean, and all it takes is to stand at some, you're getting some booksellers and people and online behind the book, you know. I mean, because they're such a good, it really is a terrific series.
Thank you.
But you have to, people don't always know, they don't know your name, so you have to sell the series, you know. You have to tell them it's really good and read it, you know, and it's... And the word, I mean, you're not one of those authors who can get your name on the side of a bus, I wouldn't
No.
Not yet, anyway.
Mother's bus. My mother had a bus, I guess. No, it's good. There's what's neat. The other thing that really sells fiction is word of mouth, and I'm very glad that people really like these books. I always hear from someone that says, so-and-so told me about your books.
Well, Otto Penzler likes the series, right?
Yes, yeah. And so it's, and word spreading, you know, people... tell their friends, and at our launch party, there were more people there who I didn't know for the first time than at any other launch party. They're just people who knew the books and wanted to come. And
that's really terrific.
Yeah.
That's really, have you ever had, has anybody pointed anything out in any of the books that they didn't like, and have you ever changed something because of what somebody said?
I've never changed anything. I mean, I've changed some things technically, like I have a chief of police who helps me, a guy who's a chief of police in Long Beach Island, New Jersey, reads everything before I turn it in because I want to make sure I'm getting my cop stuff right.
And he'll tell you whether it's right or not.
You're violating someone's Second Amendment rights there or something. You cannot search that hotel room if the people are still registered. Yes, they've got to check out before you can search it. And, you know, things like that.
You got to keep everything straight. It's difficult sometimes. Sometimes the little things will get you.
On this something. One, it was, we never call it the interrogation room where they keep saying, we're going to go talk to someone in the interrogation room.
Right.
Interview room, because interrogation is just, you know, sounds like torture or whatever.
It does. It sounds terrible.
And then Lee Laughlin, who's another ex-cop who does a lot of forensic stuff, helped me out. I asked him a bunch of questions about the medical examiner and what they would look for if someone died. If someone had a heart attack on a roller coaster, would there be an autopsy? And he's the one to let me know that in anything like a death on a roller coaster, which is kind of unusual, the medical examiner would be involved, but they would not screen for any like toxins or poisons unless you specifically told them. And while you're, you know, looking at the body, look for these toxins. So I got a lot of guys who help me like that, and I do get some stuff. Whenever you make fun of Fox News, which I did in a couple of my books, I've gotten hateful emails telling me they'll never read my books again.
Is that right?
Yeah, I got a bunch.
Do they bother you?
No, because Lee Child, who's also met, tells me he gets a much worse in one of his books where he quoted some actual Iraq soldiers, you know, Iraqi American soldiers who are fighting in Iraq and their feelings, and through like five or six lines before sending him used toilet paper in the mail, they were so upset with what his character did, you know. So it's interesting.
It's a nutty world out there.
It's a nutty world.
No matter what you do or what you write, somebody's going to be unhappy with it.
And I did make one mistake. I can offer the mistake. Which one was it? It was in Hell Hole. There was a senator I created who was a really terrible senator, and it was during all the run-up to the presidential election, and I was sort of playing around with this guy might, you know, be, people are talking about him running for president and all that stuff, and I was writing it. And I was just calling him a senator. At one point, there was only one time that I used the word Republican, and I got so many hate mail. What? I knew the minute he was a Republican that he was going to be one of the bad guys. So I guess we've gotten to a point, if you use the word Republican, they're bad guys. I don't know.
That's so typical of people that write in, and you know everybody has their opinions, and
it's okay. I understand because you know some people read to escape all the stuff that's on television and all the political stuff.
Now, you also write kids books.
Yes,
you wrote Crossroads, and I think you have another one coming out.
I wrote the Crossroads and the Hanging Hill, both which won the Agatha Award. So I've got two in a row there. I got a twofer going.
Oh, Hanging Hill's already out.
Hanging Hill's already out. It's going to come out in paperback in August when the third book in that series called The Smoky Corridor will come out.
So what is this series about? I'm curious. I haven't read them yet.
It's about an 11-year-old boy who sees ghosts. And they're kind of mysteries. I think all ghost stories are mysteries at the core because you're trying to figure out why are these ghosts there? Why are they haunting him? And he's a boy in New York City whose real mother never liked him. I guess he had CPAC's mother,
right.
Father. And
how have they been received?
They've been terrific. They are on a lot of like children's favorite lists, and they've won. Well, the Crossroads won the Anthony and the Agatha, and it's been optioned to become a movie. And
which one is
the Crossroads?
Wow.
Yeah, I helped work on the script last summer. We don't know if you know that a lot of things get optioned that never become movies.
But you're working on the script. Is that a good sign?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the first step. They get a script, and then they try to get some stuff.
We all know how crazy Hollywood is. They can decide 1 minute to do it, and the next minute not to.
Yeah, so it was kind of fun. It was a fun exercise for me to work on. And then,
How is it different to write adult books and children's books? I mean, is it more difficult, one more than the other, or are they pretty much the same?
I guess the children's books are probably a little bit more difficult.
You can't get adult at all. You have to stay...
Well, but they're pretty dark. They're pretty. In fact, I have.
Why do you like writing dark stuff so much?
Because if you get scared in the story, then life is easy.
Do you? I mean, do you feel when you're writing the stories? Do you feel a darkness? I mean, at all?
Not really. I like to scare myself and make myself go. You know, like I really just want to write books that people want to read. You know, they want to just keep reading through. And I get the best letters from parents now that say that. Son has not read a book in 3 years, but he couldn't put yours down.
Well, that would be great. That would be nice.
Kids are staying up late at night past their bedtime to read my books, you know, because they're real page turners. So
their parents are writing to yell at you.
No, their parents are actually very happy. They're very happy their kids are reading.
You know? I wish my dad had let me read under the covers at night. Yeah, he always caught me. Every time I tried to read, I got caught, and it was so annoying. I mean, looking back on it, I lost all that time that I could have been reading, you know?
Yeah. And I get to go out to schools and meet kids, and it's a lot of fun. And I just sold a second middle grade series to HarperCollins.
Really?
2012, yeah.
And are you allowed to say what it's about, or is it a big...
For your mystery fans, I call it a Dortmunder for kids. But for people who don't know who Dortmunder is, it's sort of an Ocean's 11 for middle grade kids. There's a group of four kids head up by this really neat kid named Riley Mack, who's kind of a young Robin Hood who rights wrongs, but he's very clever. They put together these. I think I watched Mission Impossible too much as a kid, but they put together all these like scams and schemes and trick people into doing what they want them to do, and it's fun.
Now, do you write like a synopsis of what the series is going? How do you get it to they'll agree to publish it? I mean, do you have to write the book first and then, or do you?
This one, I was actually was working with an editor who was quite familiar with my Crossroads books. And had, in fact, HarperCollins had bid on them early, and so she said, come on in here and tell some ideas, let's do another series, and I gave them five or six ideas, broad stroke ideas, and they picked this one, and I sent her a couple, like the first chapter and stuff, and then, yeah, with the fiction, they really want to see the whole book, you know, it's fiction, you can get by with the proposal.
And they want it yesterday, too, I guess.
That wrote itself really quickly. I was really getting into that one. I was working, like, doing, like, 5,000 words a day on that one, so...
Did you ever think that you would never get John Steinbeck published again?
Yes, I did. Last year at this time, if you had asked me, I thought that was it.
That must have been really sad for you.
It was very sad, yeah. It was like a funeral for a friend because, you know, you go to bookstores and people say, how many Steinbecks are there going to be? And the author has no control over the fate, you know? And,
right.
You know, so my word to your listeners, if there's a character you like, sell them. Get as many people as you can to buy them. That's the only thing that really, you know.
Or do you like Danielle still, buy 1,000 copies of your first book?
Right.
Apparently she did. I don't.
Wow.
I've heard that she did. I shouldn't be spreading rumors. Who knows if it's really true? You never know what to believe anymore. But CPAC's such a great series. I mean, I can't even imagine it ending. And a friend of mine said recently she thought Rolling Thunder was the best you've written so far.
Oh, that's good to hear.
So how does that make you feel?
Well, I've been getting that a lot, actually. A lot of people really seem to love it. I'm wondering what I do. But...
And I must tell the audience out there, when you get to the end of Rolling Thunder, you're going to be very, very thrilled. This has the most thrilling ending in any of your books, I think. And it builds up slowly, and then all of a sudden everything starts to happen. And I just like the way you do that.
I think it sort of almost turns into a thriller for the last quarter of the book, and I'm finding out that people seem to really like that.
So. And it's interesting because I have one friend who I've gotten to read your series, but she read the one where the guy gets killed in the toilet stall, and that turned her off for some reason.
Huh.
She couldn't read that one, and I tease her about that. I said, maybe you'll go back and read it. But I don't know, there was something about that that just bothered her.
Interesting.
Isn't it weird when things bother people?
Yeah. It's because some people thought that one was too dark. But
I mean, we live in a society where, I mean, I sell books in the bookstore, but you have to always be, people, when they hear what a book's about, it's instantly going to either excite them or turn them off.
Right.
And, you know, you don't know what the person's like, and you don't want to give them something that's too heavy. I always warn readers if it's something that I know is very intense or gory or whatever. But you've never written any gore, really.
No, my wife would tell you that Sleigh Ride, my one of my thrillers, there's one scene that is so gory in it, and only because it was based on what the Russian mob actually does. And that one was like, oh, my God, people are calling her up saying, is everything okay at home? That was awfully dark.
But you probably enjoyed writing that scene.
it was very realistic.
What was your childhood like? I mean, did you write a lot when you were a kid? Did you know you were going to write a lot?
Yeah, I think I started writing when I was in fifth and sixth grade, and I had some teachers who told me that I actually had a teacher who wrote on one of my little essays I turned in, you're going to make your living as a writer someday. So I got a lot of encouragement early on. And
how old were you at the time?
Probably like in fifth, sixth grade, like 11, 12.
So did you have a lot of ideas going through your head even then?
Yeah, I was sort of imitating Art Buchwald, I remember. I don't know if you're old enough to remember Art Buchwald.
Oh, I remember Art Buchwald, sure.
They'd send you home to write an essay about Halloween or Thanksgiving, and I'd turn it like an Art Buchwald kind of column with all sorts of funny stuff in it. And
You seem to have a very good sense of humor.
Yeah, thank you.
About things. I can sense it just by talking to you that you probably have a sense of humor.
Yes, I think I got that from my dad, so he had a really good sense of humor.
Could you ever see yourself writing a very funny book?
I'm not sure, because it's like funny movies, like the funniest movies, like Caddyshack, which I love, and that sort of thing. There's not much story to them, you know? But if you think about even the Marx Brothers movies...
Well, just think what a challenge it would be.
Yeah, I know. No one's been able to do it. No one's been able to write...
Well, I mean, you look at Janet Ivanovich, who writes comedy every book. But, I mean, I'm not saying I don't like her books. I think the characters are somewhat similar for each book. I mean, I know the plots change, but it seems like, you know, how many cars does a woman destroy in the course of her life?
Right.
I mean, it seems like she goes through three or four cars every book. Now that's a little over the top. But people love those characters. Those characters are so ingrained in people's minds that they'll buy the book every time.
Right. Yeah, I like writing. I'm sort of a mix. I mean, that's what my editor at Random House does, the kids' books. There's a lot of comments he gets from people that the kids like. They say it's like the perfect mix of scary and funny. It must have been all those years I wasted studying Shakespeare where even in the tragedy, there's always like a little comic relief along the way. So I like telling a good story that makes you raise some questions in your mind and that sort of thing.
Well, what questions do you think the Rolling Thunder raises in your mind?
Let's see here. I think it raises an awful lot about sort of fathers and what it means to be a father. There's a lot of father stuff going on
mm-hmm.
in the book.
How did you get along with your father?
Pretty good. He was a little distant. He had five sons.
Right.
And was busy.
Not a lot of time for one out of the five.
Exactly. And I was always puzzled by my...
But he was nothing like John Seabeck's father, I hope.
No, no, it's based on someone else's father.
I just am thrilled with John Seabeck's father. I'm very... It's almost to the point where I just have to know what in the world made this man the way he was. You know, are we going to find out some more stuff about his father?
I'm not sure. You know, I have him making this vow that he's going to leave his son alone, but I don't think he's the kind of guy that sticks up for him.
No, he's got to keep popping up because that's when the fun begins.
Yeah, when he shows up, you know, it's trouble. He's just so scuzzy.
He's just a terrible person. I mean, you hope you don't know anybody like him in real life.
No, I don't. He's sort of a mixture of some people I've bumped into.
But, well, what about John and Danny? Are they anybody you've ever met?
Well, Danny is probably me, you know.
Oh, you're Danny.
Probably a younger version of me, sort of in awe of all these people.
Have you done a lot of the stuff that Danny's done?
No, the gun stuff, I'm not as good as Danny is with guns. But that sort of looking up...
A ladies man?
Yeah. He's not a ladies man, especially he knows everybody in town. He's like friends with everybody.
Well, hey, I don't know, Danny's kind of like a ladies man, don't you think?
I guess so. He seems to have gone out on dates with everybody.
I mean, he doesn't seem to be very full of himself, but he does seem to like the women.
Yes.
I mean, it's not a terribly apparent thing, but not like some men, you know. But it seems there's an underlying.
Right. No. Yeah. He appreciates the feminine pulchritudity and all that. But Seabeck is kind of based on a nephew of mine who was in the Marines during the first Gulf War. Physically, kind of looks like him, got the jarhead thing going on. And ethically, he's based on a pal of ours who's a captain with the New York Fire Department. Just because you just wonder what makes some people run into buildings that are burning down when everybody else is running out, you know. And it's, you get down to this code they live for something a little bit bigger than themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always the guy on the sidelines sort of marveling at them and their ability.
You seem to have a lot of fun writing books. I mean, it seems to be something that you really enjoy. I mean, do you ever get to the point where you don't know what to do next in a book when you're in the middle of a book?
No, I'm getting more to the point where I know that what I thought I was going to do isn't what I should do. That's about where I am now. I'm in the middle of working on the fourth book in the kids series, and I'll dutifully plot out things like, oh, wait a minute, they're not going to do that. Because the characters start interacting, and they start getting into situations, and one thing leads to another. A lot of what I do is grounded in my time spent being an improvisational comic here in New York, where you just say yes to whatever your partner says and you just keep going.
Mm-hmm.
You see what happens. You put, you know, two diametrically opposed characters in an interesting location or an interesting situation and see what happens.
Do you... I assume you've done a tour for Rolling Thunder or in the middle of one, or...?
I've gone to a couple bookstores, a couple libraries, yeah.
And do you get crowds?
Yeah, the libraries, I get like 20, 30 people, which for a book, that's a pretty good crowd. And when we had our party, we had like 40 people came for the kickoff, so.
Can we expect another John Seabeck?
I think so. They're making noises that they're very happy with how this has all been going. And I think I have an idea for the next one.
Oh, you do? I mean, do you get the whole idea for the whole book, or do you just get bits and pieces?
Usually I get an idea for... there's a really good, Hallie Efron writes a really good book about how to write mysteries, and she always talks about, like, an out-of-whack moment happens.
Right.
You know, there's always, like, an out-of-whack moment. Once you get that out-of-whack moment, then you sort of, well, how'd that happen? And then you know what really happened. You know, like, the guy found dead a locked toilet stall mystery in for Hellhole was, like, the out-of-whack moment. Like, how'd this happen? How'd this guy die? Did he really commit suicide in the toilet stall? And you know, or... In this one, I wanted to play around with the all those warnings that you read when you're waiting in line for a roller coaster ride. You know, do mm-hmm. this ride if you have heart trouble and all that stuff. And what would happen if somebody did have a heart attack on a roller coaster? And then what? It always starts with a what if, and then I add an and then you find out that there are some people who are very happy that she's dead. And then, you know, are they too happy? So it's just one thing. It's like a snowball.
Going yeah, that's an awful family. I must say. It's like you do good writing awful families. Heartless people, you know?
Heartless, dysfunctional family there.
There is some. There's
none in the bunch, is there?
Yeah, excellent. I mean, have any chance these will ever be movies or TV shows or anything? Well, I mean, it seems like it would make a great TV show.
Yeah, Tilt the World was optioned to be a movie once, and the option sort of expired. It's, you know, a lot of things get optioned. It might make a pretty cool TV show, I think.
Yeah, I think it would make a great TV show. Now, how do these books sell down the shore?
Pretty well. There's like a whole bunch of people, and also they sell well to displaced New Jersey people who want a little taste of home. I hear from people like in Michigan, you know, I used to live in New Jersey, and this is how I go back down the shore. So they're doing pretty well.
So you're reading these books, you get to feel that you are at the shore. I mean, you certainly feel it.
Well, that's great. That's what I'm hoping. There's like a little vacation in
there. There's that atmosphere. Does writing come naturally to you, you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think I've been doing it for so long. You know, there's that great Malcolm Gladwell book about Outliers, where if you do anything for 10,000 hours, you're pretty good at it. You know, you just get...
Oh, is that what the basis of that book is?
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. Anything for 10,000 hours?
Just about anything you do for 10,000 hours. Like, I did not realize this, that the Beatles performed basically for over 10,000 hours before we ever heard of them. You know, we put together all the time.
That's a lot of time.
Yeah. So, you know, I did like 18 years.
So the basis is that you can get good in anything you want.
Yeah, and then also you have to be doing what you're good at the right time to become really, you know, successful at
it. Was there anything else that you did that you were good at too that you didn't pursue? Any other career?
I would think that was I was actually one of the, got a lot of great reviews for my improv comedy acting. So I often wonder what would have happened if I had moved to California instead of New York and had done The Groundlings out there and ended up doing sitcoms and that sort of thing.
Do you think that would have been fun for you?
I don't think it would have been as much fun. What's neat about writing books is that you get to be all the characters. And
right.
You get to, as an actor, you're always waiting for someone else to give you permission to do it. As an author, you are too, but to a lesser extent, if you know you've got like a book contract. And,
now, how close do you live to the beach?
To the beach?
Yeah.
We live in New Manhattan, so we go down to the shore just about every August to do some research. I usually know what I'm going to write about by the time we go down in August, and I'm taking pictures of like things like outdoor showers, like we're in this book, you know, the outdoor shower stalls. And I start spending a little too much time inside a rest stop on the Garden State Parkway when I was working on Hell Hole. Take my little camera along and start taking pictures of stuff.
Right. In case anybody's wondering, I think that was another call I had coming in. I'm just going to ignore that call right now. In case you're all thinking the world's ending or something.
Yeah,
it's funny.
Yeah.
We live in a society where everything's interrupted, you know? You can never do anything for more than half an hour or so, and
right.
Somebody has to interrupt you. So we can expect more kids' books in the future, another CPAC, hopefully. Do you have a name for the book running through your mind already?
Right now it's called Knock 'em Down in my head.
Knock 'em Down?
Knock 'em Down.
Like, is that another ride name?
It's like an arcade game. Because I was funny, I was at a library, and somebody said, do you ever think about doing a book about all those, like, carny guys, you know, where the characters of all those people who run those arcade games is really prominent, and I just had this vision of, and I was standing there in this little library going, ooh, because, you know, they always have, like, those plywood doors that they open up, and all those stuffed SpongeBobs are hanging on the walls, all the stuffed animals that you can win are hanging on the walls, and I thought it'd be great if you opened up the door, and in that wall of all the stuffed animals hanging, there's a dead body hanging up there.
That's a great idea.
And then on the train ride home from that library, I started jotting down all these notes, so I think I know what might happen. And I just like the idea of knock 'em down. I always try to find a title that will give me two levels to work on, like with Rolling Thunder. It's the roller coaster, obviously, because there's a lot of Rolling Thunder roller coasters. But also, I like the metaphor of if there's a lucky lightning strike, then thunder will rumble out from it, you know, roar.
I love the way the book starts. So we bust an 8-year-old girl for wearing high heels.
Yeah, that's a good first line.
It's so important to get those good first lines out. I mean, you read the first lines of some of the books, and they really get your mind going right away. I mean, it makes you think. What kind of books do you like to read?
I like reading all sorts of mysteries. I love Donald Westlake. I also read a lot of Stephen King stuff.
Right, and talk about a twisted individual.
Yeah, it's
I mean, how does anybody come up with some of those ideas?
But it's funny, like, oh yeah, I had that idea too. Like,
but he said, I mean, but the thing with Stephen King is, he may be gory, and yeah, you may be unsettled by his books, but he knows how to tell a good story.
Yeah, and he's also knows how to tap in, at least because I'm a baby boomer, he sort of like taps into this universal conscious of my generation.
And if he ever grants me an interview with him, I won't even know what to say.
Yeah, I was very fortunate that when he was the Grand Master for the Edgar Awards 2 or 3 years back, that Charles R. Dye did a one-on-one interview with him at the Edgar Symposium, and I was able to go hear him.
Oh, that must have been fun. Did you record it?
No, but I think they did. I think they you could probably get it from Mystery Writers.
I'd like to hear that. He's a very interesting man to listen to. I mean, you can tell he's had a very unusual life, shall we say.
Yeah, he's also very humble, too, which is kind of interesting. I always thought the most talented people are the nicest people in the world.
Right. It's amazing. And every author you meet is different. But most are extremely nice. I mean, when do you ever meet a nasty author? I mean, it never happens.
No, they're pretty nice because they like seeing people because they spend so much time alone. They're little kids.
And even with, I mean, you can imagine a lot of them go on tour, and they must meet a lot of interesting people on tour.
Yeah, it can be an interesting experience.
What would you say, in all of your life, was one of the most interesting things that's ever happened to you?
When I was out there in the bookstore?
Anywhere.
Anywhere, wow. Oh, boy.
What comes to mind when I say that? I'm
drawing a blank right now, I guess. I guess the night I did improv comedy with Robin Williams ranks up there pretty high.
You did it with Robin Williams?
Yeah, whenever he was in town filming a movie, he'd seek out...
Are you kidding? And you went?
No, I was on stage with him.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we were doing our show. We used to do our show.
Were you nervous?
Yeah, but he was the nicest guy in the world. He was, like, very shy backstage. Because I was doing Shakespeare improv with Robin Williams. Like, that was pretty cool.
I can't imagine. I wish I had a video of that.
That's pretty cool.
Is writing everything you wanted it to be?
Yes, it's a lot of... yeah, it is, actually. Because, you know what, I learned early in advertising that the part I get the biggest kick out of is when I'm writing anything for the first time and things are really clicking along before I've shown it to anyone. You really have to enjoy that part because you don't have absolute control over whether anything will live or die, you know, whether it'll ever get published. In my case, writing commercials, you never knew. We used to write 100 commercials for every one that got produced. So you had to actually enjoy coming up with the idea and writing those other 99 scripts. Otherwise, you just go crazy if you're like, if I don't sell, I got to sell this idea.
Well, I don't know what the figures are, but I would assume that a new author coming along, writing a new book, it's got to be difficult to get published. I mean, what...
Oh, yeah, it's getting harder all the time.
The big book, I think this year they're talking about, is that one called The Passage that's coming out in a few weeks. But, you know, how does one author... And then, you know, they're putting all this... advertising behind it and doing all the stuff, which only helps it. But you actually wonder what makes a good book for publishers. What do they look for in books?
I have no idea.
And I guess if we knew that, we'd probably be bestsellers, wouldn't we?
Yeah, but they, you know, they find a book that they want to get behind. I just don't know how it works. But I don't know.
When you think of the best books you've ever read, what books come to mind?
Well, as we approach its 50th anniversary, probably To Kill a Mockingbird. And also, my absolute favorite book of all time is A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving.
Which I think they made a movie out of, didn't they?
It was horrible. It was so bad they made him change the name to Simon Birch.
Oh, right.
Yeah, the book itself was brilliant, I thought.
He is a brilliant writer. I mean, you may like him or not, you never know what's coming next in those books.
And then Stephen King, I always remember Pet Sematary. I don't know why that one sticks with me.
Yeah.
Because I just read it over a perfect summer. You know, it was a perfect read for, I remember a summer up in the Catskill Mountains or something. And it was one of those things where I had time to sit down and read this book all the way through. And it was so scary and so creepy. And I kind of knew what was going to happen. But yes, oh my God, it did happen. And it was cool.
Can we expect a CPAC in the next couple of years?
A CPAC book in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, do you think it'll be published next year or the year after?
I think they're already talking. I think my agent's talking to them about doing something for next summer, so.
No, next summer, cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's something good to look forward to.
Yeah.
And your kids' books, Crossroads, and what's the other series going to be called? Does it have a name?
Right now we're sort of calling it Riley Mack and the Other Known Troublemakers. and it's going to be this kid Riley Mack at the center, and that'll be out in not until the winter of 2012. And this year, The Smoky Corridor, the third book in my haunted mystery series, will be out. And that's going to be a cool one because it's got a zombie in it.
Now, do you know how many books are going to be in the series, or do you just keep going until they say don't write?
Keep going until they say don't write.
So you don't really have it's not like a series where you have the beginning, middle, and end planned.
No, and that's what is kind of frustrating because people always say, how many feedback books are you going to write? And you have to go,
as many as they'll let me, yeah. Until it's not fun anymore.
Yeah.
I would assume some series do get old after a while, but it's amazing how some you never get tired of.
Right.
Well, this has been absolutely great to talk to you.
Thanks for asking me on.
It's always nice to have you. The book, again, is called Rolling Thunder, and it's out from Pegasus Books. It's in all your bookstores now, and it's, like they said, a bright peach cover. I love this cover. It's like psychedelic.
Salmon or something.
Exactly. It's been great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David.
This has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you later.